Welcome to episode 8 of the Skip to the End podcast. I'm Ben.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Mark.
And on this week's edition of the podcast, we're going to be reviewing the new thriller starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Nightcrawler. We're going to be talking about our top 3 animated films of all time. We're going to be discussing films that deserve a sequel. And we're also going to be discussing our homework. This week, my homework was to watch Jaws.
I had The Mist.
And I had The Taxi Driver.
So let's get started. So last week, guys, I set a topic for us to discuss our top 3 animated films of all time. It's a tough one, it's quite a broad subject because we're not necessarily just talking about Disney films or Pixar films, we can talk about anime and various other things. So, Adam, what have you started with?
This was really difficult, actually. Just narrowing it down to 3 seemed to be the hardest task, I guess. Mm-hmm. There's so many good things out there. Like you say, it's not just Disney or Pixar. We're talking anime, Studio Ghibli, things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm leading off with something. It's not the greatest film of all time, but it was something that I always wanted to see, and it was great for me to bear witness to, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie called Final Fantasy VII Advent Children.
Okay.
It's a completely CGI movie by sort of Square Enix, who they used it as a follow-up to the video game Final Fantasy VII. Now, again, it's not the best film of all time. It's one of these films that if you watch it, unless you played Final Fantasy VII, you'll have no idea what's going on. But as a follow-up to see where the characters were kind of 3-4 years down the line, it was a really cool thing to watch. And some of the visual effects are unbelievable. It was really sort of testing the power at the time of what CGI can do. And Square kind of had a history of doing this. They released a film called Final Fantasy The Spirits Within,
yeah,
which as a film was not good at all, but the visual effects on it were unbelievable. It's completely CGI, and it's just one of those films where everything just seems to work perfectly within it. So, I mean, that's my number 3. I absolutely love it, and it is a follow-up to one of my favourite video games of all time.
The second one you mentioned there, what was it called? The Spirits Within?
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen the whole film, but I think I saw a documentary about the making of it, because I remember them showing them how they did the CGI for every sort of individual,
yeah,
strand of hair.
Yeah.
And this was quite a while now. This is probably, 10 years ago when they made this.
Yeah,
so the technology's moved on quite a bit. But even back then, I remember seeing this and how they'd done each individual strand of hair and thinking, this is so impressive.
If you see it now, it still doesn't look dated.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. Aki Ross from The Spirits Within was actually the first CGI character to ever be in, Maxim's Top 100 Sexiest Women of the Year or something like that. So that's to go to show the detail they kind of put into their films, and Advent Children was no different to that. The storyline, again, like I say, it's not amazing, but as a fan of the game Final Fantasy VII, it kind of just picked up where that left off, and it was a great thing to witness, I guess.
As someone who's never played the games, could I go and watch that film and enjoy it as a standalone thing?
No.
Fair enough.
I've seen both those films, and I've not played the games, and I was like, I don't know what's going on.
You'd probably enjoy watching it as a spectacle, like the effects, the graphics,
yeah,
stuff like that, but you'd have no idea what was going on. You wouldn't have a Scooby about the story.
Right, okay.
When I watched it, it was one of the only animations that I've seen that gets the human looking so perfect.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the films, even people like Pixar, they never quite get the humans right, which is,
yeah,
good, because they make them look a bit different at times on, what was the second one?
Advent Children.
I honestly believed it was actors. It was so perfect.
Some
if you slightly squint or something, the movement, the way they blink, everything, it's absolutely outstanding.
Yeah,
it really is the closest effect you can get to real life.
So
hats off to them.
Number 3, Final Fantasy VII, Advent Children.
Nice. My third choice is Akira.
Yeah.
I absolutely love anime. I've watched dozens, if not hundreds, of anime films over the years, and this is undoubtedly one of my favourites. Directed and written by Katsuhiro Otomo, who I believe wrote the original manga and a novel as well. And it's a mind-bending piece of work. That it's one of those things that stretches the limits of what an animated film can be. You know how when people talk about the best novels of all time, and they'll throw in Watchmen, even though it was a graphic novel, they'll put it alongside other novels.
Yeah.
This, to me, a film like Akira is a film that I don't hold up against other animated films.
You hold it up,
I hold it up against other films. You know, I would put you guys know how much I love Blade Runner. I would hold Akira up against Blade Runner, that same sort of dystopian future thing. They're very similar types of films to me.
To me, I love Akira.
It is an absolutely fantastic film.
Amazing film. I've recently bought it on Blu-ray. They came out as like a so many years anniversary edition in a nice steelbook and stuff. And I put it on. It doesn't look dated at all. It looks unbelievable. The colour and everything. It looks.
I think you've kind of touched on an interesting.
It's violent.
You've kind of touched on an interesting point there as well, because a lot of people even look at Pixar and Disney films in their own bracket.
Yeah.
But there's certain animated films where you can hold them up to, you know, the top 10, IMDb's top 10 films of all time, and they can kind of hold a candle up to them as well, which is fantastic, really, for an animated film to do. Something that, especially in the Western world, is seen as a more of a childish thing to watch. Whereas anyone like myself who's seen films like Akira realises that they're not really suitable for children.
Yeah, and it's true that what you say, that in the Western world, it's only really probably been in the last 10 years where adults are happy to go and pay and go to the cinema to watch what used to be seen as a kid's film. You know, we'll go and watch a Pixar film and won't even blink.
Yeah.
But maybe 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have done that as an adult.
Unless you had children.
Unless you had children. Whereas anime films have been, you know, in Japan, there are children's cartoons, you know, Pokemon and whatnot, but there are also adult anime, and it has been an established thing for, well, I think since the 60s, probably manga was first being written and the film started being made.
Long time ago.
It's a good point, actually. I remember when I was a kid, I'd only be able to go and watch these films on, like, a Saturday morning during, like, they had, like, kids' clubs at the cinema. Yeah. Like you said, now, Toy Story 3 was probably on at 10 o'clock at night. They knew how many adults wanted to go and
well,
check
I
it out.
I remember in the summer going to a barbecue around my friend's house. We had a few drinks, burgers, you know, standard. And at 12 o'clock, we all, well, about half 11, we all piled into a car.
Skip to the end.
One of our friends who hadn't done drinking. And went to the cinema to watch Monsters University.
Yep.
For a 12 o'clock show.
Probably full of stoners, but
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay, so I'll go with my third choice. My first one is going to be Spirited Away.
Yeah.
It was only during university that someone introduced these films to me. They've been around a while, but I wasn't really a massive fan. I didn't know enough about it to really comment. He lent it me on DVD. At the time, I think it was like a Region 3 or 4. It was like a imported version, so just watch this, and since then I've obviously gone and watched Ponyo and The Wind Rises and
Porco Rosso.
There's so many good titles out there, and
I hope
you've
not just touched on anyone's two or one.
Well, you have, that's my number one, but we'll come to that. You keep talking, I'll jump
shit
in.
All over you, fantastic movie, the soundtrack, everything, the animation, it just made me want to go and visit the whole box set. And
It's, as I've just said, Spirited Away is actually my number one choice. It is, to me, hands down and by far and away, the greatest animated film I've ever seen. It's the most beautiful looking film. It's a beautiful story. It's quite moving. And the thing I love about it is, when just a minute ago we were talking about how animations aren't for just kids anymore, they're for all ages. When I first saw this film, I think it came out when I was at university, so I'd have been 18, 19. And as a teenager, it blew me away. I loved it. I've then watched it probably 24 times since, in my 20s and now in my 30s, and I love it just as much as I ever have. I first showed it to my little brother about 2 years ago, who would have been 7 at the time, and he fell in love with it as much as I did. So, you know, from a 7-year-old to a teenager to 20s to 30s, we're having the same reaction to it. It's just the most beautiful, amazing film. Hayao Miyazaki, who directed it and directed most of the early Studio Ghibli films, is a no-fooling genius. I don't throw around the G-word very often, but he is a genius. His direction, his writing. Spirited Away is my favourite, and not in my top three, but Porco Rosso was just outside my top three. I think that's a work of art. Princess Mononoke's great. Howl's Moving Castle, so much great work. And like you said, Mark, it does make you want to go and get the whole box set. But yeah, Spirited Away, I completely agree with your pick. It's my number one.
Am I right in thinking that The Wind Rises was the last ever release from the studio now?
It's not the last release from the studio. It's the last release under him, I think. Right. I think he's retiring from the animation side of it.
It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
Adam?
Okay, yeah, number two. Well, always going to put one Disney film in there, I thought. So we've got to go with it. And the one I've chosen is Aladdin.
Okay.
It's a personal favourite of mine, I think, back from when I was a kid. So it's the one I kind of watched the most, that and The Lion King. But Aladdin just scrapes it for me. Gilbert Gottfried, Robin Williams, Robin Williams we spoke about quite a lot about on this podcast. Aladdin is that film. It's got a great storyline to watch, funny characters, and just a general action-filled film as well for a kid to watch. So I had to go with it.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it in 20 years. I remember loving it as a kid, but it's been a long, long time since I've seen it.
I think it's one of those films that would have the same effect on you watching it now, just because you kind of remember how you felt as a kid watching it.
I think since the advent of the CGI, Pixar and DreamWorks type films, I've kind of fallen out of love with the old school Disney animations. I just haven't. It's not that I've fallen out of love with them per se. It's just I haven't gone back and revisited them, because the Pixar and DreamWorks films seem to have moved on a notch.
And there are, you know, Pixar and films that are an absolute work of art as well, as I'm sure one of us will discuss it a bit later. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine one of, we've got a top three of each without having one Pixar film in there. So again, Aladdin for me, it was great animation for its time as well. Mm-hmm. And there was just certain things that you kind of pick up on as well when you grow up and you've moved on from that. And there's a few sort of level jokes for adults as well as kids. So it had to make my top three as one of my favourite films as a kid.
And the soundtrack's great. So many good sing-alongs. Good, really good tracks. So.
Robin Williams is, again, his voice was even good in half the songs he did.
Good choice. You've just mentioned there that there was no way we were going to do a top three animated movies without mentioning a Pixar, and you're absolutely right. My number two choice, my second favourite animated film of all time, is Monsters, Inc.
I think
it is the laugh-out-loud funniest of all the Pixar films.
And what a brilliant concept it was.
Fantastic.
Monsters scare kids for energy.
Yeah, I think it was directed and written by Pete Docter, and you think, what was he smoking when he came up with that?
Because brilliant.
Just that idea that they're stealing the screens for energy, and just the whole story, and little, you know, baby Boo, and what the character is it, Sully and Mike
with one eye.
Yeah, and they're so funny. But that thing about where it came from also helped me. It's just such a brilliant film.
Even a great performance from Steve Buscemi as well as Randall.
Yeah.
I mean, what a character he was as well. And I thought one thing that I loved about it was the design of each individual monster.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing looked the same.
Yeah.
They're all very different. And 2119 as well, where the orange monster keeps getting kid socks.
Keeps
getting shaved. There's just so many laugh-out-loud moments in that film.
And weirdly enough, after having talked about that Final Fantasy film, I saw the documentary about the strands of hair, there's the same thing on the making-of featurette that's on the DVD and Blu-ray of Monsters, Inc., where they show how, like, you know, Sully's blue hair, and they show how they made every individual strand of his hair as well. And just the depth that goes into making these CGI films is phenomenal.
That was the one kind of demo disc for me when I used to show off TVs when I used to work in sales. Mm-hmm. I used to put on Monsters, Inc. and say, just look at Sully's hair, because you could sit there and every time, even he just talks on it, I mean, his hand's near him, every little bit of his hair is moving up and down, and the detail they've gone to, you could pause any scene and the way, it's unbelievable. It's frightening how much, detail they go to, and that's just his hair.
It looks beautiful. And it just is a great film. Not only is it laugh-out-loud hilarious, it's a brilliant story. The ending's amazing.
Yeah.
Really moving as well. In fact, can I do a bit of self-imposed homework? I haven't watched Monsters University yet.
Ever?
No, I just not got round to it. So can that be my homework?
Yeah. Go on then. Why not?
There we go. Brilliant.
And it's a good film. I won't say anything about it, but you won't be let down.
Cool.
So number two for me, I've found that, I think, Adam, you've said before, not many computer games work well as a film. And they seem to cash in a lot. But on this occasion, Street Fighter 2, the anime version, I really enjoyed that film. It was one of the first animated films I saw with a lot of blood in it.
Yeah.
And I was a massive, massive Super Nintendo geek as a child. I used to probably spend my whole 6-week summer holidays thrashing that game out with my mate. And when they announced a film that was coming out of it, we watched it and it was unbelievable. I think it was the first animated film I had that was an 18.
Yeah.
You know, we had to get it on video.
It was awesome.
And the soundtrack's got Silverchair and loads of rock bands and decent rock music on there, but the animated itself is amazing.
The question is, though, is it better than Street Fighter the movie starring Kylie Minogue and Jean-Claude Van Damme?
I had a piss this morning.
One of those questions that can never be answered, but I
first saw this film, the animated Street Fighter 2 movie, on, I think it must have been like Sci-Fi or one of those channels.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 14, I think, I was
playing with your rocket.
And I was just flicking through the channels, and there it was. It was on Sci-Fi. So I sat there watching it, and I was actually quite sort of mesmerised. I was kind of just getting into anime at that stage. Mm-hmm. I just started watching things like Dragon Ball Z, things like that. And that kind of really gripped me. I was like, oh, what's this then? Sort of Street Fighter 2, just starting. And it absolutely blew me away.
Mm.
I loved it. It was so true to all the characters as well. Like, it's weird to say for a Super Nintendo game, the depth they went into with the character backstories of these people, despite the fact that back then games didn't really do that a lot, especially fighting games. There was no, like, Tekken does it now as well, but there wasn't anything like that. And they made these animated features, and I think it was the 15th anniversary Street Fighter 2 that came out on PlayStation 2 actually had that film on the disc.
Yeah.
It always makes me laugh, going off on a tangent a little bit about Street Fighter. You know how over here on the English version or the PAL versions of the games that we had, the final boss was M. Bison?
Yeah.
But they changed some of the names from the Japanese version.
Yeah,
So in the UK, M. Bison, I think he was originally Vega.
Balrog.
Or he was Balrog then. I think he was Vega because there was a three-way triangle. So yeah, I think Bison was originally Vega in the Japanese. Balrog was originally M. Bison because he was supposed to be a riff on M. Tyson. Mike Tyson, he was a boxer. But they decided we can't call him M. Bison over here because Mike Tyson will sue us for copyright infringement. So they switched the names around. So that's how Vega became M. Bison.
Wow.
It was a really weird thing because I think some of the translations they did later on down the line actually hindered that as well between Japan and the American dubs.
Right then, so the number ones.
Number one, indeed. Well, we've already heard Ben's.
Yeah, Spirited Away.
I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit more when we get back to him. So my number one, and again, it's not the best animated film in the world, but it's probably one of my favourites, and it's the Cowboy Bebop movie.
Oh, cool.
I absolutely love Cowboy Bebop as a series. For me, it was Firefly before Firefly was. It was about these sort of space bounty hunters who did missions, and Spike, who's the main character, is one of the coolest guys in anime for me.
Yeah.
So when the film came out, I was a bit apprehensive because anime films from anime shows or from manga generally are okay but not brilliant. But I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was fantastic. So just to see the characters from Bebop on screen again, absolutely loved it.
I think the creator of Cowboy Bebop was at the London Comic Con that we went to. I think he was there. So it's a shame he didn't get to...
Take it away, boys.
Shame we couldn't have spoke to him then.
I remember a couple of years ago, there was in the works in the US plans for a live-action Cowboy Bebop movie. And the guy that was apparently signed tentatively to play the lead character was Keanu Reeves. So, putting your thoughts of Matrix 3 aside, how would you have thought of Keanu in the lead role there?
No.
All right.
He doesn't, no offence, Keanu, if you're ever on this podcast at a future date.
Next week, mate, so what are you saying?
I don't mean to have a go, but you don't have the charisma needed for Spike's people.
You mean the living bit of oak that is Keanu Reeves doesn't have the charisma for the part?
I mean, Spike's one of these characters that he has that kind of charisma, and he's really good with people as well, and he's quite a funny character. I mean, the last episode of Bebop, the animated series, he does something brilliant. I don't really want to go into it, because if you haven't seen Cowboy Bebop, watch it.
Mm.
Not just the movie, watch the entire series.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by it. I've seen they've recently released it on Blu-ray, a big box set of all of them for the first time, restored and all this bastard. Yeah. And it looked, I remember all these different colours, like each episode had different like red cover, yellow cover, and it did make me think, oh, this looks really interesting, but I didn't realise it was your favourite ever, so it must be good.
Yeah, I mean, I could do a whole podcast on my favourite animes.
Well, I'll tell you what, now that we've got a brand new website, skiptotheend.co.uk, how about sometime soon you put together an article about your favourite animes of all
time? Sounds good.
28 pages worth. Do you want me to give you my number one? Because obviously yours off.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really need to say much else about Spirited Away. I've said everything I need to say.
Are you sure?
It is the most beautiful, not just animated film, it's the most beautiful film I've ever seen. It's, you know me, I'm a miserable old bastard, but it's a film that actually moves me. And I love it so much.
I'm glad to hear that you really do adore it. I didn't realise it was your favourite, so that's a real interesting discussion. So mine, I think you both picked up on either Disney or Pixar. It's got to be Up.
Okay, yeah. I saw that for the first time about a month ago.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Up, for me, is one of the most moving stories ever. Considering it's aimed for children, spoiler here, but the opening sort of 10 minutes, there's a scene where his wife basically dies, and we see the amazing times they've spent together. They basically go through getting a house together, getting married. They couldn't have children. But it's a really sweet sort of five-minute bit of animation where you basically see her die and leave her on her own. And it's really dark.
It's dark,
really sad. And I'm sure every kid that went to see it was crying, because I've watched this film with my wife, my mum and dad, when I first got my house, they came and watched it on the big screen, and my mum was crying at that scene, you know. And
it's horrible, it's, isn't it? It's
absolutely
brilliant.
Heartbreaking, yeah. And you feel so sorry for the guy. Luckily, in his life, we have this little Boy Scout come and visit him and take him on his mission to go and visit the certain...
It's like Paradise Falls, is it?
Yeah, and it's... I'm not going to read the whole story out, but it's incredible. There's Doug, the dog that comes on the
Doug's
adventure.
Doug's amazing. Love Doug.
He ties his house with about 10,000 balloons and flies there. But the story's amazing. It's really colourful. I love the way that Pixar completely changed the look of their humans from The Incredibles or Toy Story. It was completely different to anything you'd seen.
It was as well. And like you said, the design of each individual thing was beautiful. And the colours they use in that.
It was amazing. All the different coloured balloons and everything. It was absolutely unbelievable. The voices, again, from Pixar was brilliant. But it was just what I liked. It was just different to The Incredibles. It was different to Toy Story. It wasn't like Finding Nemo. It was something completely out of nowhere. Again, do these people do a lot of drugs to come up with this storyline that they need to get a house to the other side of the world? The only way they can do it is by tying balloons to it.
Just interestingly enough, I know you mentioned just then about the opening sequence, 5 minutes. I remember seeing a documentary on Pixar, and they talked about that scene as one of the best things they've ever done. And that was originally scripted to have loads of dialogue in it, and you know them being told that they can't have kids. And they ended up, they kind of animated it before they recorded any of the dialogue.
Yeah.
And then they watched it and realised that this didn't need
it
dialogue.
Does not need any at all.
They just put music over it and it was perfect.
It's absolutely...
And that's one of the advantages incredible. You kind of get with an animated film.
Yeah.
You can do that. You can look at a scene before any of the voices are imposed on it. So,
A couple of things I wanted to pick up on there. You said, yet again, you wonder what they've been smoking. That's because this one was written... Up was also written by Pete Docter, who did Monsters, Inc. It was written and directed by the same people.
I think he
did the story for...
I think we should be careful about what we're accusing this guy of.
Well, I'm not accused of anything specific. The other thing is, you were talking about the voices as well. I think as the main guy, the old guy, Ed Asner, his vocal work is so good. It's one of my favourites.
So distinctive.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And a brief cameo from John Ratzenberger as well.
He's in every Pixar
He's well
film,
known for, I think Pixar actually referred to him as their kind of lucky charm.
Yeah.
Apparently whenever he does a voice in a film, it always ends to gross X amount worldwide.
I'm assuming he wasn't in Cars then.
I don't think he was, actually.
That'll be it then.
But they love him as well.
We've had some come through on the Facebook page this week, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. So we've had Ben Slaughter, who's put the original Lord of the Rings animation.
Never seen it.
It's very trippy.
Oh, God, yeah, that's really old, isn't it? I think it might be from the 80s or something.
Ralph Bashkies, yeah. I think it was. Really old school.
How many Oscars did that win?
Everything. We've had Ian Evans with A Scanner Darkly, The Incredibles and Toy Story.
Yeah.
So, Scandalky was that
sort of
Keanu Reeves.
Animated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ryan Kenshu with Aladdin, Toy Story, and Nightmare Before Christmas.
Has no one mentioned My Neighbour Totoro yet?
Also a great film.
We had Miriam with The Lion King, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Toy Story. A lot of love for Toy Story.
Yeah.
We've also had Lee Renton with Ghost in the Shell.
Brilliant film.
Spirited Away, and The Lion King.
I like Ghost in the Shell. I don't think I put it in my top three.
No, it's too short as well. It's about. Just over an hour, I think. It's a really short film.
Darius Cobb with Despicable Me. I mean, that was a massive, massive success.
Cool. I've only seen the second one. I've not seen the first one.
Wow. Richard Francis with Lion King. But every time, you know, the best... He said that he's recently bought the 3D of it as well. They've reconverted it, and it's supposed to be unbelievable. Okay. And Pinocchio, considering it was made in 1940. Absolute genius.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of love for any old Disney films like that, where they've made them in the 50s and the animation.
Hand-drawn.
It's unbelievable, really.
Yeah.
Matty Vinyl Crime has put Basil the Great Mouse Detective and Akira. Lois Netting Alexander has put Alice in Wonderland and Fantasia. I mean, Fantasia is one of the most craziest, bizarre animations I've ever seen.
It's another one where you just wonder what the hell.
I'll be honest with you, I hate it. I don't like it.
It
annoys me.
I think it's weird and not in a good way.
Paul Dawson has put Batman Mask of the Phantasm, which is probably something you're into, Adam.
Cheers.
When the Wind Blows and, My Neighbour. And what was the one you said earlier? My Neighbour.
My Neighbour Totoro.
Yeah, he agrees with you on that.
Yeah.
We had Mark Holloway with Ratatouille.
Good film.
Yes. A brilliant film. Well, look, some people love that or hate it.
Patton Oswalt's vocal work in that is great as well.
Gemma Hurst with Toy Story, Spirited Away, and The Triplets of Belleville.
Mm-hmm.
We've also had Kevin Horton with Magic Roundabout, Roger Rabbit, which I suppose is half animated.
Yeah. Are we classing that? Is that allowed?
Yeah, we'll give it that.
If one of us would have said it, if Mark would have said it, I'd have given him as much shit as I gave him for saying Sandman. Last time.
He said you're still waiting on a Rocco Modern Life movie.
That would be unreal. Because Rocco's Modern Life was badass.
Brilliant.
He used to work. Yeah, he used to work at or used to visit a restaurant called the Choky Chicken.
Yeah, this is a kid's cartoon.
Wayne Talbot with Akira, Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah, that's good.
Steve Buin with Jungle Book, and finally Mark Walker with The Lion King, Toy Story, and How to Train Your Dragon.
I haven't seen that.
Brilliant film. The animation's incredible. Cool. DreamWorks got it right.
Okay, well, thanks for all your suggestions, guys. I mean, this really was a hard topic.
Yeah, it was. It was a tough one. It was a good one to discuss. Now, I believe, Mark, you've come up with an idea for a topic for the next podcast.
Yes. So last week I was sat at home topless watching Top Gun.
Amazing.
Which is the rules. I don't know if you've got the DVD. It says, please take your top off before this movie starts. It's
now
the
I've
only
got
way.
That edition. Only rooms around yours.
I really forgot how 80s that film is. The soundtrack, the feel of it, the look of it. And I just thought, it's one of those movies that you could not watch now and think, it looks dated. You know,
yeah,
it's an 80s
movie. It is an 80s movie all over.
So I was thinking to myself, maybe, yeah, a list of three complete 80s movies for you that completely feel like
80s. Quintessentially 80s, that look 80s, feel 80s, and even sound 80s.
Yeah, those amazing cheesy 80s soundtracks. Cool. So next week, bring those three choices for the 80s, and we'll have some nice, cheesy
cool
films to talk about.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. We've been to see Nightcrawler, a new thriller written and directed by Dan Gilroy, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as the amoral, essentially sociopath, Lewis Bloom. There will be spoilers on this because we can't really discuss the film without giving away key plot points. Essentially, it's about how Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Lewis, finds a new career. He's a chancer who's looking for something to do, a way to make a quick buck. He starts the film off as a thief, and he manages to stumble into camera-based journalism, essentially him reporting on injuries and murders, getting his camera there and selling the images to the various news channels, or to one news channel in particular. So, what do we think about the film in general? Mark, I'll start with you.
One of the films that I come out of the cinema thinking, whoa, that's very different to anything I've seen for a long time. Really interesting film, and I've been thinking about it for a couple of days since, you know. Adam?
I'd echo most of that sentiment, to be honest. I think one thing that was good is the amount of time we've left it to talk about it from seeing it. It was one of those films that it does really require quite a bit of processing before you can decide whether you enjoyed it and liked it or whether you didn't. My initial thoughts were that I enjoyed it, but I wasn't sure whether I liked it.
Yeah.
Having had a few days to think about it and really process the way it is and how it was shot and some of the, you know, the acting performances themselves, I can say I liked it.
Yeah, exactly the same with me. I think all three of us, when we first came out of the cinema, said, you know, we love Jake Gyllenhaal, and we'll get into his performance later, but we didn't know really what we thought of the film as a unit. And yeah, same with me. Over the course of the last few days since we've been to see it, it's played on my mind a lot.
Yeah.
I really, really want to see it again.
Yeah.
It was something utterly unique. I've not seen anything like it before. And just the character of Lewis Bloom is completely immoral and a complete sociopath. He's only interested in getting ahead, getting where he wants to be in his life and his career, and the amount of people that he screws over to get there in just such a gleeful way.
Yeah, I mean, the opening sequence is fantastic in the respect that when it shows him for the first time, he tries to appear to be, you know, kind of likeable. The security guard comes up as he's trying to cut this chain link fence out to steal it, roll it up, put it in his boots, we can go and sell the raw materials. He starts, you know, making excuses as to, oh no, I'm sorry, I just got lost, the gate was open. He said, no, the gate's broke. Oh no, it was open, honestly, I just drove in here by accident. And when he realises the guy's not a cop, he's just some security guard, he even says, oh, private uniform, I like them. And then ends up basically strangling the guy and taking his watch.
Yeah, and he then wears the watch throughout the rest of the film after beating the guy over and nicking it.
So, I mean, it's just a character point of how much of a sociopath, I guess, Lewis Bloom is. But I think the way you described it perfectly, he's a sociopathic chancer.
Yeah.
He's just any way he can make money, he kind of goes about trying to do that. And there's a great scene when he's selling off the raw materials and he tries to get a job off the foreman of the construction yard where he's selling the material. And he goes, I'm not going to hire a thief.
Yeah.
And I think Lewis Bloom just smiles and walks off.
And that's after Bloom had given this clearly well-rehearsed speech about how he was a self-starter and a quick learner and he'd be a perfect man for the team and all this kind of stuff. And then the guy's just like, I'm not hiring a thief. And off he walks. Yeah. And then it's later on, I think that evening, that he's driving home and he drives past a car accident.
He chances onto this new career, as you put it.
Well, yeah, just out of morbid curiosity, he steps out of the car to take a look at what's happening. And as he does, a camera crew turns up, led by Joe, played by Bill Paxton, who starts filming it. And Lewis Bloom starts questioning Joe, saying, why are you doing this? What are you doing with that? Oh, we're going to sell it. Sell it to who? The highest bidder. And then you see the little spark go off in Lewis's head, thinking, right, here's a way to make money. Let's do this. So he goes off and buys the cheapest, crappiest camera he can find.
Even steals a bike to trade it in at a pawn shop to get the camera and the police scanner. That's a greatly a well shot scene as well, because the way we see the scene is actually we just see this biker cycling along is it Venice Beach?
I think so, yeah.
And he kind of just stops to go in somewhere, chains his bike up, and as he stops, you kind of see Lewis sitting under a tree on a hill, and then the next scene you see is him riding the bike into the pawn shop. So again, it's very character driven.
Yep.
As a film, it's all about kind of him, his relationships with people, and how other people he finds are. Some of them are in a way as bad as he is, but he's just willing to go that extra mile to be worse, which is a great take on the story, really.
Mm-hmm. What I think was nice about this film is the fact that none of us knew anything about it when we
went
in.
Yeah.
Normally, for the Guardians, Sin City, we all know the backstory. We all know what to expect. We've probably read a lot of spoilers.
We've seen the trailers and months.
This is something that we knew nothing about. On the whim, we went, let's go and see Nightcrawler. A Sunday quiet night, got in there. None of us had any source material to go off. Mm. We don't know anything about the director before this.
No.
And we were basically going on the fact that, we're hoping that Jake's going to get an Oscar nod for this, and we wanted to see what this hype was about in this performance.
We'd seen Jake Gyllenhaal and things. We'd seen Rene Russo and things over the years. Bill Paxton as well. Riz Ahmed is a relatively newcomer to the screen. But as you said, I think I've probably seen one trailer for this film about a month ago. Mm.
I hadn't even seen the trailer. I read a very brief review saying that all I could gather from it was that Jake Gyllenhaal was a journalist and he's very good in it. That's basically all I knew going into that film. So it was nice having that fresh canvas of something to enjoy.
So where do we want to talk now? I mean, to get into the story of the actual film? Because story itself wasn't really much to it.
Yeah, there isn't much of a story. It's about how Lewis gets ahead. And there's a scene when he realises
what he's willing to do
to get ahead. And when he realises that he's got a good deal going with this one particular news station and the director of news for the breakfast show is Nina, played by Rene Russo. When he realises onto a good thing there, because he's got a real knack for this job, because he has no morals, he doesn't mind sticking the camera in dying people's faces and, at one point he sneaks into the house of a family who gunfire had ripped through their house, and he sneaks in when the police aren't looking and takes close-up pictures of their family photos. And he doesn't have
even moves around the family photos around the bullet holes
to make a better composed shot. And when he realizes that Nina needs these pictures that he's bringing to him, he realizes his worth, and he basically badgers Nina to go out on a date with him. And he effectively says to her, I want to have a sexual relationship with you. And she's like, I'm not interested, I'm twice your age. And he says, look, I know that you're the lowest rated news show. I know that I'm the best at this. I know that whenever I bring you these blood and gut stories, your ratings points go up.
You need me.
You need me. I know your contract's coming to an end. Without me, you'll lose your job, you'll lose your health insurance, so you're gonna sleep with me. And it's one of just the darkest, nastiest things I've ever seen. But Jake Gyllenhaal is so good. And he's not like any sociopath I've ever seen. You can imagine that same scene with Patrick Bateman, played by Christian Bale, and it would be a completely different scene. It would be more menacing. This was a more quietly menacing, because he's a very sort of nebbishy character.
Do you know, I found him really, really disturbing, and since thinking back to him in that film, just the facial expressions, or just the way he looked at the camera, or the way he was, and when you think back to some of the scenes where he was having these conversations, he was always coming across as the nice guy, and he just seemed like too nice, that was disturbingly nice. And I remember at times he would be like, he seemed like everything he ever said had a meaning, and everything he said was scripted. Mm. And it was like he was always reading off a sheet of paper. He was slightly like... He had those kind of characteristics about him that you would think he probably wasn't all there, you know, and he would be saying stuff. But do you know what I mean?
And I do,
the
I
way
do.
He was talking, he wouldn't just talk like me and you and have those normal and people skills.
It seemed like everything was planned to the hill. Every speech he made seemed planned.
But his people skills and everything, the way his social interaction was so... He was slightly wrong.
Yeah,
he was something so different. But he had the eyes of Anton Chigurh. This is something I felt. When he looks at people, he gave the same look that Javier Bardem does.
Yeah.
As Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men.
You wouldn't want to meet him.
And I thought that was unbelievable. It was a fantastic just eye movements, facial expressions from Jake Gyllenhaal.
And a lot of that came from the fact that he lost, I think, 20 or 30 pounds for the role, and he looked really thin and emaciated.
Yeah.
His jawline was so angular, and then his eyes just bulged and popped out of his skull. I don't think he blinked throughout the whole film, it seemed like. He just had that intent look on his face.
And it's the twisted morality he has as well. Mm-hmm. The scenes where he's being interviewed by detectives, and you can tell that he knows the law. You can tell that he knows exactly what's going to get him in trouble and what isn't. And how to hide things. I mean, there's one scene where he actually arrives at a triple murder before the police even do.
Mm-hmm.
And he realises he's kind of firming up the path of the murder's still going on. There's people still being shot in the house. So he kind of hides in the bushes, films at these the two culprits leaving, getting in the car, driving off. And then he, instead of calling the police straight away and making sure they arrive, he actually goes in the house, films the bodies.
Some of them haven't even completely died. They're lying there in pain, and he's kind of just getting
the weirdest thing. The weirdest thing for me is, and this is the bit that kind of stuck with me, when he walks into kind of a nursery, and everyone in the cinema is hoping, oh, please God, don't let there be a baby in there. But you know he's thinking, please let there be a baby in there.
Yeah, because that would be a money shot.
Because that, for him, would be the perfect shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all he's thinking about. He's not thinking about the well-being of anyone in that house. He's not thinking about the family and friends that have to see that on the morning news and realise that their friends are dead.
No.
He's thinking about how much money he can get from this one sequence.
And the thing you mentioned there about how the crime was in progress, the two killers, he caught them on film, but he never gave that bit of film to the police because he wanted to set up his own crime scene.
Yeah.
So he basically tracked down the killers himself, followed them, set up a situation where the police would arrive, told the police that they had a gun, engineered a shootout and then a car chase between the criminals and the police and himself, chasing after them at Christ knows how many miles per hour. And it's a fantastic scene that, again, it's all about him, what he is willing to do to get what he wants.
And it's all surmised by Rick Riz Ahmed, where they're in the car together. The cars crash, the police cars crash. The guy is in the car, overturned, and Lewis Bloom gets out the car. He goes, I'll check you stay in here. And he goes off and he looks in the car, sees the guy still alive, walks off telling Rick, the guy's dead, can we get the money shot?
Yeah.
So Rick Riz Ahmed gets out the car with his camera. As he walks towards the car and starts filming it, Lewis Bloom's filming him get shot from the criminal in the car.
Yeah, he engineered it so that his own colleague, his own teammate, someone was murdered in front of him.
For weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
By that point, that wasn't a surprise, I take it, by this. You knew that he was so twisted, and did you get into the mind of him and think, well, actually, this isn't going to be a bit of a twist here, my God. You just knew that
there was going to be some underlying
sinister here that was going to lead to his benefit.
Yeah.
And I think that Riz Ahmed was really good as a supporting
role. I do as well, yeah.
You know, he kind of was just bullied throughout the whole film. You know, he was grateful to what... He wasn't anyone that would ever go out and get a proper job. I don't think he had much of an education, and in the end, does he sign up for $30 a day or something?
Yeah, as an internship.
And he's working for him, and as a manager, you know, it was Jake's character was just a bully and was just absolutely awful. But the fact is, there was no other way this guy was going to get money.
He was the weirdest kind of bully as well. He wasn't particularly nasty all the time. So he always kind of gave him a bit of encouragement here and there. And when it originally wanted to give him the job for free, and say it was an internship, it builds experience. And then Rick says, I've got to be paid something. So he offered him $30 a day. And then he kept saying, there's a performance review coming. And when the guy asked for more money, he said, this is time. It's time you earned more money. How much do you want? And basically gave him a blank check. So the guy says, was it $75 a night? And he says, brilliant. He said, fine. He goes, and then Rick even says, I could have gone higher than that. He goes, yep. You could have. So he was kind of quite open with him as well, yeah. And he said that communication was the key between the two of them.
And that's that bargaining over there, over Rick's wage, was what led to Rick's eventual downfall, because there was a bit where they went to...
He holds them to ransom.
Yeah, he goes to chase. They go to chase those two criminals, and Lewis mentions that there's, I think it's a 50 grand reward, yeah. And Rick wants to split it 50-50, and Lewis is like, no chance. And Rick says, well, if you don't, I'm going to leave, and I know that you've set this up. You know, he basically holds him to ransom. So Lewis agrees, says, fine, 50-50. But then after Rick gets shot, Lewis goes over to him and Rick's saying, why have you done this? And he said, because you took my bargaining power away.
Yeah.
And that was his reason for letting him die.
It was
just brutal.
So, I mean, we've spoke a bit more about the story now, so let's go into the characters themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. We've touched on Lewis Bloom quite a lot, but let's overall impressions, we know, sociopathic. Jake Gyllenhaal.
I find myself saying this again and again, and I need to find a film that's dreadful for a performance, but I don't think this is his best performance. You know, yeah. Donnie Darko's fantastic, and that's the first time we saw him.
Prince of Persia,
do you know what I mean? That I'm not even going to comment.
No.
No, it's film your best performance in a bad film.
What's the film that you really like, Adam, that you always watch when you're at home?
Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah. No, but also in Brokeback Mountain with the late Heath Ledger.
Mm.
Great performance, but I'm not, you know, it wasn't as good as this. This was...
generally put in fantastic performances, and he's one of these people that... whenever he does a good performance, it always seems to get nominated.
Yeah. But this, for me, is...
for some big awards.
I would like to see him awarded for this.
He's got a fair chance at a nomination, I would say, for that.
Yeah, I don't think he'll win it, but he's got a great chance at a nomination.
He owns the film. He's in damn near every scene. Quite possibly every scene.
I believe he actually is in every scene.
And he just holds the screen magnetically all through it. Everyone else is very much a secondary player. Like, I think Rene Russo is really good as Nina, as the station boss, but it's a minor role comparatively.
I think one thing we should also talk about when it comes to his character is the downfall of Joe. Bill Paxton's character.
The rival cameraman.
He's kind of a rival. I think they actually call themselves Nightcrawlers, don't they?
Do, yeah.
He's a rival Nightcrawler. He ends up setting up a second van, as he calls it, so they can cover twice as many stories, and they can only cover sort of half the city each, which means they can get to a lot more and double the stories per night. So he ends up actually offering Lewis Bloom the role of owning the second van. He said, that can be yours, you know, 50-50 partners kind of thing. Lewis turns him down, and in the end, Joe ends up setting this other van up. And then Lewis finds that he gets to a crime scene one night, and this other van's there. And the guy, and Joe even says, could have been yours. Could have been yours.
Yeah.
So the next day we see Lewis actually go to Joe's house, kind of go under his van, appears to kind of cut the brake lines.
Yeah.
And then instead of going to the crime scene that night, he's actually following the van around waiting for the crash.
Yeah.
So that he can film the crash.
Yeah.
And I think Rick even says to him, oh, come on, man, don't do that, he's one of us. But Lewis doesn't care. He's like, no, he's the story now.
And even when he's been... so, obviously, Bill Paxton's character, Joe, is in the stretcher. He's bleeding from the throat and the mouth. It's absolutely horrific. He can't even move his head. He's in this real tight support.
Neck brace.
And he's literally choking on his own blood. And he's there zooming in on his face.
Yeah.
And the look of his eyes is just like, you are... this is beyond anything I can't believe you've done this to me.
It's strange to say because for a character in this film like Joe, I mean, he is at the end of the day someone who profits from other people's misery.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't like him.
No, but you do warm to him, and that scene you're like, God, you didn't deserve that.
No.
When you see him get that kind of taste of his own medicine in a way, and he becomes the story. As much as you want to kind of hate Joe and say, well, you deserve that, you can't, because you know it was all manufactured by this sociopath.
And one of the weird things about Lewis Bloom, he is a sociopath, and we've listed many of his crimes today, and if you list them in a short space you realise how bad he is. But when you watch the film, he seems like such a benign villain, because there's a lot of scenes where he's in his own sort of one bedroom flat and he's sat there doing his ironing, laughing at the comedies on TV, pouring water looking after his plant. He just, you know, he's not like a moustache twirling villain. Yeah. He's not a knife wielding psychopath. He's just a guy who is willing to screw people over to get what he wants.
He's not a Patrick Bateman. He's
not
an Anton Chigurh. He's just this guy who is trying to build his own empire, his business empire. It's a completely different type of psychopath, sociopath that you get on screen.
Yeah, I've never seen this that kind of villain before. And that's something I wanted to mention was about Dan Gilroy, the writer-director. It's his first attempt at direction, and we can cover that in a minute. But in terms of his writing, he's best known, I think, for writing Real Steel, the Hugh Jackman movie, and for writing The Bourne Legacy. But this was his first sort of new piece that he also got to direct. And there was something in an interview that I read today on Vulture.com. He was talking about writing the film, and he says that he just wanted to throw out all the conventions that he normally used. He wanted to throw out having a backstory, having a likeable character, giving him an arc, having a happy ending. It was all out of the window. My hero was a villain. I'd never done that before, but I was just writing for myself. And I love that he didn't even set out to make a conventional film with a conventional arc, with a happy ending. There was a happy ending for Lewis. Lewis, the final scene.
But you
of the
don't
film,
want him to have the happy ending.
I did, because I bloody love Lewis. But, you know, one of the final scenes is him in with the police, and the police know he engineered that whole crime scene. They know he let Rick die, but he basically puts it in a way that is him basically saying, prove it, you can't. And he has a perfectly plausible backstory for why he's completely innocent. He walks out of the police station, puts on his sunglasses, and then just after that you see that he now has his own fleet of vans out chasing the stories.
It's interesting you also bring that up, because he didn't have a backstory. We knew nothing about this guy. We see him in one scene at the start, and then all of a sudden he goes into this character that he was. We don't know.
We know nothing
about his parents. We don't know anything about
him. And we didn't need to.
As a kid, we just see this guy. It's the same as you'd get from any villain in a film. You don't really know much about their past. You just see their actions, assume they're evil, and go with it. We didn't get any of that. He was the focal point of the film, and we got no backstory on him.
Yeah, and it wasn't needed. You didn't miss it. You didn't sit there thinking, I wish I knew more about what he was like as a kid.
Well,
it didn't matter.
Much like me, until you read that, you didn't even really notice that yourself. That
no,
you had no backstory.
No, because it wasn't important.
Yeah.
One thing I will say, and I think hopefully you both agree, that even though, like you said, I think there's every single shot is of Jake, I never got bored. I never for one moment switched off and was kind of like, oh, looking at my time. I never really, I don't get that feeling of just, oh, and it's a 2-hour film. Mm. You know, you could be tested.
It reminds me of a UK TV series called Life on Mars with John Sim playing the main title character, Sam Tyler. And it's only when it's pointed out to you that you realise that he's in every scene in one form or another, because it's all told from his perspective and it's supposed to be in his mind. Every scene has to feature him. And because this film is in similar in that respect, it's all from Lewis Bloom's perspective. He has to be in every scene. Even the scenes we see of the editing suite of the newsroom,
he's always in the background.
He's always at the door looking at what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating, really.
He was mesmerising for me throughout. He really was.
And that's
was
something I want to talk about with Dan Gilroy, the direction there. Because some of the shots they had with Lewis in them were absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't through his vision, it was through his camera. That you saw, I mean, there's the bit where he's sitting in his car filming the noodles place before the shootout.
Yeah.
It's all flicking between him and Rick and their cameras, so it's...
My heart was racing at that point. I had no idea. The first police car
pulls
up. And
when he got the gun out as well.
Yeah, and he suddenly goes and sits down, and you see that the criminal's got a gun as well, and you think this is going to kick off. Then the second police car pulls up, and you think they're going to clock this.
Yeah.
And before you can even acknowledge that thought, it was, and I was just like, "That's all he's doing." He could have gone there about
nowhere.
This so much easier and just, you know, called the police. This is the home he's at. He knew where they lived. Go and do it. But he wanted
the shot.
Best,
he wanted the film.
Possible gory, eventful.
And that the way that was directed, the reason why that was so tense is a credit to Dan Gilroy, who we've said was a first-time director, to get that sort of level of tension. I thought it was brilliant. It had a really sort of noirish quality.
Definitely.
And I read on some other website a writer from LA saying it was the best representation of LA they'd ever seen on film. They actually felt like they were standing on
the
street.
It wasn't the Hollywood thing. It was,
I really can't believe that's his first directed full movie. That's up there with the likes of Tom Green.
The one thing I really, really loved about this film is the fact that there are so many films I go into, I watch, I come out of, and I think that film is brilliant. 2 days later, I think, it wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
This was the complete opposite of that. I came out of it thinking, I'm not really sure how I feel about that. Didn't really seem to go anywhere. I didn't really seem to do anything. But the more I've thought about it, the more I've loved it.
Me too. It just needed to percolate in my brain for a couple of days. But as I said earlier, I really can't wait to watch it again.
Do you know what else is quite a big thing? normally we come out and we talk about how good the soundtrack was or this worked. I can't tell you one song that was on that. I don't even think they really watched was
it. It was just more just sort of atmospheric score.
Yeah.
And
it was good. Yeah. It was quite refreshing not to have a certain, you know, like, let's be honest about it, Guardians of the Galaxy is all about the soundtrack as well. That was incredible. Sin City's got the established music we associate. This, like you said, it just worked. Yeah. It was brilliant.
It was a bit like a Drive from a villain's point of view.
I was just about to say it was like
Drive.
Yeah,
it did feel a lot like that, actually.
Drive meets The Guest.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Jake Gyllenhaal was a better villain than Dan Stevens in The Guest. Shall we wrap this up with a rating then?
Yeah, let's because this is the
I always go first,
so
I'm going to put my score out last. Adam,
I'm happy to give it a 7. I think 7's a solid number. I really did like the film. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great. But I mean, I don't think it would push into an 8.
Yeah.
It's a high 7, but it's a 7.
Yeah, I agree entirely. It's a good film. It's an excellent performance from Jake Gyllenhaal. It's not without its faults. You could argue about the lack of a backstory, the lack of an actual story was detrimental to it. I don't think it necessarily was, per se.
No, I don't.
But I think that it was a very, very trim, lean, focused film that was all about this one guy and his mind. So, yeah, it's a 7 for me.
I'm just going to echo what you say. His performance is the best I've seen. It's a film I'll be thinking about, I think, for a long time, and I can definitely see myself watching this again at home for a second or third viewing, and then it might be being on the 8 territory. But at the moment,
a high seven.
So we're all saying 7.
Yeah. So the skip to the end rating for Nightcrawler, 7 out of 10.
So last week, guys, I set you the challenge to go away and think about a film that you really think is crying out for a sequel to be made. Maybe you fell in love with the characters, wanted to see what happened with them, the story may have ended, and you thought, doesn't seem the end for me. Maybe, I don't know what your reason is, but how have you got on with the challenge?
It took a lot of thought, but then when I hit upon one, I've not changed my mind. I think I've found the perfect one, and it's Unbreakable.
Brilliant.
The M. Night Shyamalan film. Because in that film, the whole point of it is Bruce Willis starts to find out that he has these powers. And then he comes across a character played by Samuel L. Jackson, who it turns out has like these brittle bones and whatnot. And Samuel L. Jackson's character, towards the end of the film, he says that as a child, he realises that if he was that weak and brittle, there must be someone out there who's the complete opposite of him, who is completely strong and invulnerable. So Samuel L. Jackson paints himself as the villain. He paints himself as Bruce Willis's arch nemesis. You know, you're the strong guy, I'm the weak guy. You're the good, I'm the evil. And at the end of that film, that's when we come to that revelation. You find out that right towards the end of the film, you find out that he calls himself Mr. Glass because of his brittle bones. He's orchestrated all these explosions and whatnot. And he gets, I think there's like a bit of writing on the screen at the end that says he was taken off to an asylum or something. And that was a perfect way to end the first film in a trilogy or something. Yeah. The next film should have come out 2 or 3 years later. Samuel L. Jackson's character manages to bust out the asylum somehow, and then we truly see him versus
Paints
his arch nemesis.
Well, the Joker lips.
Not necessarily that much on the nose, but it was set up perfectly to see how they would then actually become arch rivals. It was an origin story. That film was an origin story. What we need now are the adventures
instead
of those
being
characters.
Such a one-sided affair where one person sees himself as the arch nemesis. It now becomes a thing where both of them have that, and in a way there's kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two of them as well, where one of them can't live without the other one.
And I know that Shyamalan has, over the years, gone on about how he intends to do it, and he started writing it and whatnot, but I think the fact that he's just made a slew of atrocious, awful, terrible shit films has meant that he's not been able to get financing for that one.
It's so depressing that I didn't realise that it was even an option or an idea or he's ever discussed it, considering he's releasing
garbage.
Dog toss like Airbender and stuff like that. The fact he could have done this, it's too late now.
Yeah.
There's no point in doing it now. You've burnt your bridges.
He still had some cachet in Hollywood when he made The Happening.
Yeah.
He still had a bit of leeway there to make films that he wanted. So at that point, instead of making that absolute pile of shit, he should have made Unbreakable 2.
Did call him now. Stop him coming on the show.
Next week on the show.
But no, seriously, I agree with you. I mean, there was a perfect opportunity for him to do it, and he just seemed to not do that. Whether he couldn't get the ideas, or I mean, I don't know if he's too proud to ask for help from another writer.
One thing that definitely wasn't the thing prevented him was getting Samuel L. Jackson to do it, because as we've established, he's in every film that's ever been made. He'd have been up for it. Maybe Bruce Willis wasn't, I don't know. Maybe
so, Samuel, we've got a contract for you, it's come through. We've got Unbreakable 2, you know, the follow-up to that incredible movie, or Snakes on a Plane. What do you want to do? You know, it's...
Both. That'd be his answer.
Great, great answer, Ben. Not really one that I chose, so really I thought we answer, were going to do that. So do you want to go next, Adam, or shall I?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought really long and hard about this, because I've made a point on these podcasts in the past of just kind of saying that sequels I don't believe work as a general rule. So I really did have to think long and hard, rack my brain about this, and because there were so many options, and I just thought, no, like, I wouldn't want to see that, I wouldn't want to see that. So I ended up going with something that already had a sequel and needed a third in the trilogy, which was Hellboy.
I thought you were going to say Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2.
No, I wish.
The Matrix.
Hellboy 3.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
That is set up for a third film. That needs a third film. Mm-hmm. I think Ron Perlman and Del Toro have actually been speaking about it in the press about June like this year or something like that. But it needs a film. It needs to wrap up the Hellboy franchise, because Hellboy 1 is an amazing movie. Mm-hmm. I even enjoy Hellboy 2. It gets a lot of stick as well.
It's a great film.
And Seth MacFarlane's character, you know, the sort of German man who's in the suit, and I can't remember the character's name, but that's a brilliant character.
It's cool, yeah.
I love the second one. It's not as good as the first, but it's really good. And I think, from what I can gather, the reason why they haven't made a third is purely financing. I don't think they've been able to secure the funds to make the movie. Everyone involved, Del Toro, Ron Perlman, they want to do it.
Because, yeah, Del Toro was speaking about how, you know, we need a third film to wrap up the whole legacy of Hellboy, the fact that he was a harbinger of the apocalypse, that's what he's supposed to be there for. He needs to confront that now, that needs to be the end of his story. So Del Toro seems to have these great ideas on board. I think Perlman kind of joked that at his age now, a third film would be a lot of strain on him. But he said, when you sit down with Del Toro and speak to him about it, you can't help but be excited about wanting to do it. That was the thing that I sat there and thought, that needs a sequel. Hellboy 2 needs a sequel.
I agree with you. Talking about Ron Perlman as Hellboy, I don't know if you saw it, it was probably about a year or two ago. You know, in America, they have the Make-A-Wish Foundation, so kids who are dying, they can make a wish to meet a celebrity, like they always want to meet John Cena for some reason. that's fine. But one kid wanted to meet Hellboy. So Ron Perlman went to this kid's hospital in the full Hellboy makeup. Wow. I don't mean he bought some crappy Halloween
costume. No, he wore the one from the film.
It took like half a day to put on the damn thing, and he turned up to the hospital in full Hellboy gear just to meet this little dying kid, which I thought was amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That was really cool. Okay, so for my choice, it's a recent homework for you, Ben. Mm-hmm. Leon.
Oh, right, yeah.
So
are all the characters dead?
No. Natalie Portman's character, Matilda, obviously, I'd like to see her go off, and where we kind of see her go off on her own and what she becomes, and maybe she learns to become an assassin and we see the mission that she goes on. I don't want to associate it with this movie, but kind of like Lucy, so, you know, he's obviously the same director behind that film, but I'd like to see where that story taken. I do believe it would work. Not now, because Natalie Portman's about 20 years older than she was in that film, but
I think it would work now. I think that would be great.
More now than when she was 10.
I think so, because Leon was a grizzled old veteran hitman. So by this point, she'd be a grizzled veteran hit woman, she'd have been doing it 20 years. I think that would work brilliantly now.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I didn't take that much convincing. I think it's because I've seen it now.
He's now given you an idea, and you're going with it.
It's the fact of I've seen him in Black Swan and stuff now, and that character for me is not that same girl. But and she was in those Star Wars
films. I love it. I love how he's now given you the idea, and you've just gone, yeah, that's actually a really good one. I'm going to go with that.
So Leon would be my choice. Nice, simple. Everyone knows it's one of my favourite films ever.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Do you know what? I agree with both of your choices as much as I agree with my own. I think that's a great set of films. I would love to see sequels to all three of them.
And I just want to put it on record. There's not many films that need a sequel.
No.
But I think the three we've chosen actually sum it up quite well.
Yeah. And I think you've got some from the social media, Mark.
Yeah, we've got absolutely loads this week. So we've got Ben Davis with The Big Lebowski.
I mean, to be honest, Jeff Bridges just is the dude. His whole life is a sequel to The Big Lebowski anyway.
Gemma Hurst with Shaun of the Dead.
No, leave it as it is.
I agree with that. Yeah. I like Shaun of the Dead. I think it's a great film. But it's all kind of wrapped up at the end of that film anyway.
Yeah.
The zombies are being used in like supermarket queues now. And
what would Nick Frost do? Because he's a mindless zombie. You wouldn't be able to use him in the film.
Stuart Pickman's put, only if he can make it.
Play the same role in The World's End.
Don't interrupt me. Alright, Dad. Stuart Pickering has said the only if he can make it with Nail and I.
Okay.
Stephen Jordan has put Team America, which actually should have all been in your best comedies list.
It wasn't far off. It is a very funny film.
Yeah, it's funny.
Chris Phillips, Cabin in the Woods, The Apocalypse. Have you seen that film, guys?
I've seen Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
I don't think it needs a second film.
I think it'd be a very difficult sequel to do.
Richard Francis, Drive.
No.
No, we don't need that.
That was self-contained.
Luke Jones has put True Lies. That would be brilliant, a second True Lies. And I think I've had read somewhere that that could happen. And he's also put Seven.
Eight.
Or 14. But yeah, that would be crazy.
I don't know, I mean, what would you do with a Seven?
Play football with a head. Next goal wins. Ian Evans, Beetlejuice, Point Break.
That, yes, Beetlejuice, yes. Yep. A million times, yes, I'd love to see a sequel to Beetlejuice.
Old School.
Yeah.
Point Break or Memento.
No.
Then he was then he's put, because then I'd understand it. Lois Alexander, Private Benjamin. Never seen it.
That is Goldie Hawn, I believe. Okay. I think it's a film my mum really likes.
Ben Sinclair.
Well, that's your mum, see if she wants to do a sequel to it.
Ben Sinclair, McDonald, Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know where you go with it.
As long as Brian Lee O'Malley was involved in the writing.
In the writing, yeah, fine, yeah.
Maybe it reverses and he then has to go against his ex-girlfriends, yeah.
Yeah,
that'd be alright.
As long as, I agree with Ben, as long as Brian Lee O'Malley's involved, I'd be happy to see it happen.
Yeah. Kevin Horton with Pump Up the Volume.
I don't know what that is.
A decent Crow sequel.
Yeah. They're remaking The Crow at the minute, actually.
And Hackers, The Next Generation.
Hackers, I remember that film.
That is
and,
like, old
the computer graphics. It was Johnny Lee Miller and Angela Jolie, and I remember the graphics of them.
At the time,
and
it was like, wow.
And like Hackers were the coolest thing ever. They had like spiky haircuts and rollerblades. Oh man, I want to be a hacker.
He's also put his wife, Roz, has said The Goonies, and I have actually read recently they are remake. Well, no, it is going to be a sequel,
yeah.
And it's going to be some of the original cast.
Goonies!
That'd be great. Elliot Towles, LA Confidential.
No. Great film, but I don't know what you would do. I don't know, actually, because I think the... Is it... Yeah, I mean, that's from a James Ellroy book, and I don't know if he's actually revisited that universe, so maybe he has written other books with the same characters.
Which could
I don't
be
know.
Fine.
So, yeah, so maybe.
Sally Burton has put, I've always wanted to know what happens, so Pretty Woman.
I don't give a shit.
Anna Toon, Elf.
Elf 2! Elf 2 would be brilliant. Elf is so good.
Every year, just bring out a new film.
But again, Peter Dinklage would be like, though, Peter Dinklage would be like, I'm not in it, I'm too big for that now. Not literally.
Kevin Horton's been on again. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang 2. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is brilliant.
It's a really good film. It was the film that got Robert Downey Jr. His career back, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This one's for you, Adam. Robin Grace, Matrix 4. So we actually get an ending.
Yeah.
Never, just... No, I don't ever want to hear Matrix.
Was there a second and third?
In that horrible nightmare. Tracy Morgan, District 9.
That would be interesting.
That would be brilliant.
Fucking prawn.
James Howe with Cloverfield 2.
No. One was enough.
I like that film, Cloverfield.
And finally, Mark Walker with Unbreakable.
Yep.
Blade Runner.
See... As much as I adore that film, and as much as I'd like to see things going on in that universe again, I don't want to see 72-year-old or whatever he is, Harrison Ford, pretending to be Rick Deckard. It's again, although we're going to see him pretending to be Han Solo, so I don't know.
And, and spookily, he's put a third Hellboy, so he's predicted two out of our three.
That's mad.
That's weird. Really weird.
So, yeah. Thank
so basically what you're saying is the people on social media agree with me and Ben, but not you.
Mm.
Standard. So thanks everyone who contributed on Facebook.com. /skip-to-the-end podcast. We really appreciate everyone taking the time out and doing this, and it's great to see some of the input. Right, next week, Ben, any ideas?
Yeah, I want to ask you, what is your favourite under-the-radar film? And what I mean by this is it's a film that you absolutely love, that you go back to time and time again, that you always enjoy, but if you mention it to other people, they go, what's that? I've never heard of it. Because it was a film that maybe just wasn't a blockbuster, wasn't a big release.
Okay.
Maybe the critics ignored it. So I'm not talking about a guilty pleasure film, you know. I'm talking about a solid good film that just wasn't a big movie. So it might be because it's old, it might be just because it's a small independent film.
Not necessarily one people haven't seen but haven't heard of.
Yeah, haven't heard of. It's an under-the-radar film. One that you absolutely adore, but when you mention it to other people, they go, oh, I've not heard of that. So next time, guys, let me know your under-the-radar movies.
So what's becoming a regular feature on the podcast now, a bit of news and chat, and it's about superheroes, DC, Marvel again. Exactly. So Suicide Squad, we've spoken about it before and how this could be the surprise package of the DC franchise. So Margot Robbie from Wolf of Wall Street is being touted around for Harley Quinn.
See, I think that's really interesting. I absolutely love Margot Robbie in Wolf of Wall Street, but it's literally the only thing I've ever seen her in. So as great as she is in that, I know very little about her because I've no other frame of reference. But I'm intrigued by her as that character because it's a really good character. As I've said a million times, I'm not really up on my DC characters, but the Batman universe I know quite a bit. And I really like the Harley Quinn character. And I love the fact that she wasn't from the comic books initially. Yeah, she was from Batman the Animated Series and resonated so well with the fans that they eventually brought her into the comics.
And I think that's going to be a plus for Margot Robbie as well, because this is someone who's never been played on the film screen or television screen, really, as by an actor. So there's no frame of reference. It's not like someone's going in as... you know, Bane now, and people are going to hold it up to Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
Or Ra's al Ghul is being portrayed again, and, you know, Liam Neeson played a fantastic Ducard / Ra's al Ghul.
She's going in as the benchmark, which is great.
Yeah, she's going in as the benchmark.
Yeah, good on her.
In a similar way to, I guess, Jack Nicholson did with the Joker. Mm-hmm. There was Cesar Romero before him, but that was more of a TV thing, not a film.
It was a campy villain. Jack Nicholson's villain is campy as well, I guess, but not as much as Cesar.
Yeah, it's different. So, I mean, she has that kind of benefit, but I'm kind of with you, Ben. I don't really know a lot about her. I've only seen her in Wolf of Wall Street. Mm. And she is very good in Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
But it's not the same character at all. I mean, there's a complete other spectrum, someone like Harley Quinn.
Yeah. I mean, one would hope as an actress Margot Robbie's got range and can do a variety of characters, but I think this will be the litmus test as to whether that's true or not.
I mean, we've got, obviously, Will Smith still being touted around for it. Apparently Deadshot is what they're talking about for him.
Right.
Which would be very interesting. Mm. And then news coming out this week as well is that the Joker might be portrayed in the Suicide Squad. Now, apparently David Ayer has actually written him into the script. He wasn't in there originally, which makes me wonder if Warner Brothers DC Comics have said, right a minute, let's get that elephant in the room out of the way, because regardless of who you cast now or how he's portrayed or how he's put into a film, everyone's always going to compare him to Heath Ledger at this stage. So Jared Leto is the man being touted around for it again.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that? You've mentioned Jared Leto.
You know I have sort of a cognitive dissonance when it comes to Leto. On one hand, I know he's a great actor. I have seen Dallas Buyers Club and I love him in that film. On the other hand, as I've said more than once, he's a 40-year-old man dressed as a 20-year-old playing music to 14-year-olds. There's something not quite right about him.
But surely that's perfect for the Joker.
Well, maybe.
A great actor is a bit weird.
Yeah, true. But I think the point you made about Margot Robbie, about how she's... the point you both made is that she will set the benchmark for this character. Jared Leto has the complete opposite issue.
This
character
issue
has been played many times, and definitively a couple of times. You know, Jack Nicholson's Joker was the definitive Joker for 20 years. And then Heath Ledger came along and rewrote the book and is the definitive Joker now of our generation. So what can Leto do to stand apart from those performances?
My only...
I think the scripting's a big thing.
Yeah, I also think good on him if he does take on this role, because I heard that Ryan Gosling was offered it or has been in talks, and kind of rumour is he walked away, but I have a lot of respect if he signs the contract to do this role, because nobody in their right mind would want to step into the shoes of the most incredible performance I've seen of the Joker by Heath Ledger.
Except another Academy Award winning actor.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone... Who would do it? There's no one out there at the moment that you could cast, I will do this. Even these established actors, Leonardo DiCaprio, they couldn't do it.
I love Ryan Gosling. I think he's a great actor. Mm-hmm. But for this role, no. Not the Joker.
I don't know, because it depends how they write the character. I think the characterisation of the Joker in the Suicide Squad will be wildly different from the character from The Dark Knight. I think they'll have to make him a different kind of Joker so that they stand apart.
I think he'll be crazier. He'll be more about the laughing gas, the electro buzzers, the acid flowers, things like that. But you need a crazy personality to play that.
Yeah.
And Gosling doesn't strike me as having a crazy personality.
No, he does seem like a dour sod, doesn't
he? Yeah.
If you told me, say, 5 years ago that the annoying, shitty singer from 30 Seconds to Mars was going to go into a Batman movie and play the Joker, I'd have been dead against it, absolutely dead against it. Now, I know when everyone announced that Heath Ledger was going to be in it, everyone, I've read stuff online, dreadful actor, 10 things I hate people about you, actor, should not be doing this. I've read horrible comments like, oh, that gay guy from Brokeback Mountain, he doesn't deserve this role, there's no way that can work. Whatever you say, people have to turn around and say they were wrong. They were proved wrong.
Yeah.
Do you know what? After watching Dallas Buyers Club, he will probably nail the part. He was so good in that and completely changed my whole opinion on him. And I have to put my hands up and forget the singer to 14-year-old girls and trying to cling on to that. Forget that. Look at him as just an actor in this. He was phenomenal in that movie. I heard that he used to turn up to set already. He did all his own makeup.
Yeah, he did.
He came in costume. He was always character. Whenever he was talking off set to...
Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah, throughout the movie... He would only ever be in character, even after when they go for a beer and stuff. He's credit to him. If he does that as the Joker, does his own makeup, it could really work. It could really, you know, it's a real mental case that's just obsessed with the character.
One of the things that's come out this week as well is Nolan sort of broke his silence on working with Heath Ledger a bit. And he did talk about how the characterisation of the Dark Knight Joker was very much his script and Heath supplying what he supplied to the side of it. So, I think with the Joker, there needs to be a natural chemistry with whoever they're starring opposite. So Affleck's going to need to have this natural chemistry with the person playing the Joker if they do end up putting into the Batman films as well. I say if they do, they're going to have to. If you're casting the Joker, there's no way he's not going to end up in a Batman film.
Should have cast Matt Damon then, shouldn't they? Perfect Joker.
Do you know what the worst thing is? By the time...
He'll be Robin.
By the time people are listening to this, they'll have announced it's Ryan Reynolds or something to annoy us all, and it'll be, oh, Justin Timberlake's been announced, but Justin Bieber.
Don't shoot myself.
That'd be good, though, because then we could have curse of Heath Ledger dying, so hopefully he'll play the part, and then we'll see Justin die.
It's been a few weeks since you wished someone dead on the cast, so I think that's fine.
This week, Justin Bieber.
It's been missing. It's one of the features that...
We've had a lot of emails.
People writing, about it. Mainly from a Mr. G. Lucas.
there you go. There's this week's marks. Want you dead, Justin Bieber.
There we go. So another bit of news is that Star Wars have unleashed their title for Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Boring.
Yeah, and it means nothing. It's a title. Stop moaning about it.
I didn't moan. No, you asked me an opinion.
I'm talking about Twitter. People on Twitter are moaning about this title. It means nothing. Revenge of the Sith sounds like a cool-ass title. Shit film.
Yeah. It's not a great title. I would have liked them to have put a bit more imagination into it. Something a bit different. But as you say, it's just a title. It's going to come down to whether the film's any good or not.
The Phantom Menace sounds like an amazing title.
Yeah, I remember being super excited when they announced that.
Look at that.
Look how disappointed we were then.
I have seen quite some funny pictures of, like, The Force Awakens, The Force gets out of bed, The Force has lunch, The Force is brushing its teeth, The Force goes back to bed. I don't know, it's a title, I don't care, I want a trailer. Stop judging it by 3 words, 4 words, just let them announce a title.
Something Mark's just said then is the thing that gets me. I don't care about the title, give me a trailer.
Yeah.
Show me the bad guy.
Yeah.
Let me know what he's going to look like. I don't care about the title.
I would take a 10-second teaser trailer that just shows us what Han, Luke and Leia look like now. Just that. Just them.
Coffins.
Well, I'll tell you what. Go and watch this film with your homework this week. Cocoon. That's what they'll look like.
But in all seriousness, it's a title. I mean, it is news. We need to talk about it.
Yeah.
But it is just a title. And Twitter went into meltdown when it came out. Half of them were saying, oh my God, what an amazing title. The other half saying, what a crap title. Doesn't mean a thing. Show me a trailer.
All those people at home will be in the cinema on day one.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Twitter is forever going into a meltdown. The first sign of anything, Twitter will go into a meltdown. That said, get us an STTD podcast.
Brilliant.
Homework time then. So, Mark, what did you have?
Taxi Driver.
Ben?
Jaws.
I had The Mist. Mark, you want to kick off?
Yeah. So Taxi Driver is one of those films that is on everyone's kind of top 10s, top 20s. I feel awful that I've never got around to watching it. It's, for years I keep saying, oh, I need to watch that. And after you confessed to not watching Goodfellas, myself not watching Godfather 2 and 3, I felt it's time to watch another performance which a lot of people say is De Niro's finest. Wow. Mm-hmm. I only watched it yesterday. De Niro, I didn't realise how young he was in this film. That's the first thing I noticed. That guy can act.
Really, can he?
Yeah.
It's all things to tell him.
Breaking news. But yeah, unbelievable. I sat and watched it with my wife last night, who's seen it before. And she wasn't doing that annoying thing of, get ready, this bit's amazing. You know,
which is always good.
I had no idea about any of the story, even though it's up there in, I'm sure IMDb put it in their top 10. I had no idea what was going to happen. So I'm watching this guy, looks like he can never sleep, driving around. The shots of the city were incredible.
Yeah, you know, really good.
The old school taxis as well, they look so good. And it just defines that era and everything. It had that feel, I think it was made in 1976, and it looked like a 70s film. It was beautiful.
And that's the thing about old New York. New York in the 70s and 80s, basically before Rudy Giuliani got in and cleaned up the place.
Yeah.
New York was a shithole, but a shithole with so much character.
But
and Scorsese was the guy who could really nail that on film.
And De Niro was the guy that was perfect for any role in that city because, he said, great actor, amazing actor, but so good at playing the guy from the shithole that is New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the city looked incredible. I think you just picked up there, like, the director made it look unbelievable. The way the lights are shining, the colours of the different, you know, the cars and everything, it looked unbelievable. But forgetting all that aside, down to De Niro, he was pretty much the main guy throughout the whole film. Mm-hmm. Again, he's one of these films, we're talking about this a lot recently, he's in nearly every scene. To see him go from kind of this really nice taxi driver at the start, real kind of lovely guy that's struggling to sleep, the way he went in and asked about a job, I really felt for him. I was like, just give him the job, you know.
Yeah.
Just, this guy hasn't got much qualifications. Give the guy a chance. Skip an hour and a half and see him covered in blood with a gun. Mohawk.
Yeah.
Looked like the most badass I've ever seen in my life. That transformation within
it's something
a 2-hour
else, isn't
film
it?
Is... I don't think there's another film where you get from one character to another in a space of 2 hours, but it's always the same guy, and you're never questioning this change of person.
Yeah.
It was...
I mean, it's a fine
so
line
powerful.
Between hero and villain as well, because briefly before that, I think he tries to assassinate a politician, and then, because he just wants to kill something or someone, and then he ends up obviously going and killing all these pimps and... Mm-hmm.
What did you think to Jodie Foster as a teenage prostitute?
It was... old was she in that film?
She was 12, 13.
It's
like
a really weird one to watch because, I didn't know she was in the film, so I was really surprised. My God, she looks young.
There was so much controversy caused when
imagine
she was
being
cast,
around there in the 70s and seeing that in the papers and stuff, like, you know, young 12, 13-year-old girl portrays prostitute. But she did it really well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... you could see that this girl's going to have a good career ahead of her. What was the...
Are you talking about the character, her career as a prostitute?
As an actress. Jodie Foster. So, Sybil Shepherd's character was outstanding as well, and I've seen her since then in Moonlighting, and I felt she was really, really good in it, and that was a character that probably didn't get a lot of hype, and I don't think after the film many people talked about her performance because she was up against the likes of the daddy now, in my opinion, you know. Let's be honest about it. De Niro in that film. The thing is with him, I've had a real weird experience. I've not gone back to his older films until recently, so it was only a few years ago I watched Raging Bull. Now, recently, I watched Godfather and Godfather 2. I've seen these amazing performances, and before that, unfortunately, I've watched stuff like Meet the Parents...
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
And that's what he is to a lot of the newer generation.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the generation that won't, you know, who saw him in Meet the Parents, and they won't see him in anything serious.
Yeah.
It's only the guys who, like myself, who, you know, I'm 26, so I missed out on all of De Niro at his best. It's only that I'm into film that I go back and watch this stuff and see how good he was back then.
Whereas you're going to get people who are sort of in their late teens or early 20s, you talk about Robert De Niro and they only know him for the shit that he's been in, and they'll be like, oh, well, he's no Jason Statham.
But this guy could do what he likes now. I mean, for all I care, he can do Rocky and Bullwinkle too. He can go off and do another Meet the Parents. It doesn't matter. This guy's body of work is just tantamount to genius.
Yeah. You've had a really couple of good weeks of homework, Mark, having seen Taxi Driver this week and Silver Linings Playbook the week before.
Yeah, they're just really decent films.
Two opposite ends of his career, opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of character, but just both brilliant performances from him.
Yeah, and I think sometimes I overreact and get a bit too, oh, it's the best thing I've ever seen. And then I think about it a few days later and maybe I just got a bit too caught up in it. But this has probably got to be one of his finest performances. Yeah. You know, it's... At the moment, it's my favourite film of his. I only saw it yesterday, so it's still very fresh. But it was memorising. And it's
Taxi Driver's the film where you know he's going places.
Yeah. I mean, it's the one that still to this day when people do... Oh, that was an attempt at a joke.
That was hilarious.
Jesus Christ. It's the thing where if people try and do a Robert De Niro impression, it's that film that they quote from. You know, the whole You Talking To Me thing. That's the standard impression people do, because that is the lasting impact that film has had.
So thanks for that homework, and yeah, I've had a great few weeks. So
fantastic. Ben, do you want to go, or do you want me to go?
I will do, yeah. So my homework this week was Jaws.
I hate the way you just said Jaws, because if you're not going to like this, we're losing listeners, respect.
The film was amazing.
Brilliant.
I loved it. And dude, this film, honest to God, I've not watched a film that has grabbed me by the heart and the ball simultaneously so quickly. I'll be honest with you, I wasn't expecting that much of it, because you know my thoughts on sort of Spielberg 80s, 40s, 70s films in this instance. So I put it on, and I was sitting on my laptop just sort of surfing the net whilst it was on in the background. And for the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes, I was looking up from the screen towards the telly every now and again. And then after about 15 minutes, the laptop lid went slam, and I was just in the zone. I think the moment when I slammed the lid down on my laptop was when Quint turned up. And you know, when he scrapes his nails down the chalkboard to get everyone's attention at the meeting. And from that point onwards, Quint is undoubtedly one of my favourite characters in movie history. Quint rules. It's a brilliant performance by Robert Shaw, but the film is gripping, it's entertaining. I knew what the film was about. I knew it was about a shark, but I didn't know the first sort of third of the film was set on the beach and, you know, the shark attacking citizens. Yeah. But then the last two thirds of the film, it's the three guys, it's Quint, Hooper and Brody out on the boat chasing Jaws. I know this shark's not actually called Jaws, but, you know, chasing the shark.
It Bruce the shark.
That's what Spielberg called it.
Yeah.
But it's brilliant, the whole chase and how they eventually bring him down, and there's just so many great scenes. One of the best scenes in it is a scene where, I think it's after the first night they find Jaws and they hit him with the harpoon and get the first barrel on him, and then he manages to go underwater with the barrel. So they retire back to the cabin, and the three hunters are there just drinking all night, and they're singing sea shanties and whatnot. And then they're talking about scars. And Brody points out one of Quint's scars, and he went, oh, that's a tattoo. And then Quint, they ask him why he's got rid of his tattoo, and he goes into this monologue about how he was on a ship during World War II, and part of his duties was to take parts of the bomb that they were building to drop on Hiroshima. But then the ship sank with like something like 1,100 people on it, and only something like 300 survived, because many went down with the ship, and then loads were eaten by sharks. And it's just this gripping, insane monologue from Quint about the shit he went through, and I just could not look away. I don't think I blinked for about 3 minutes just watching this scene. And then there's other scenes towards the end. Everything with Quint, every scene with Quint is gold. But then there's a scene right near the end when they've managed to get the oxygen tank in Jaws' mouth, and Brody's up on the sort of mast of the boat aiming at him, and then just as he's about to fall the last shot, he says, "Smile, you son of a poof!" And then he blows up. Unbelievable, man. I am annoyed at myself that I've not seen this film before, and I can't wait to watch it again. I might very well watch it again this weekend, because it kicks all kinds of ass.
You know the scene...
I just want to take a moment just to appreciate... I think this is the most excited I've seen Ben about anything.
Good, because we'd have lost a lot of respect.
Jaws is one of those films that I don't think I've met anyone that didn't like it.
Hmm.
So you were kind of the whole test of this.
Right.
This was Ben gets to see Jaws... Let's see Ben's thoughts, because Ben doesn't like Spielberg that much.
Would the podcast been down a member if I hadn't liked this? Would it have been a two-man operation?
Yeah, I believe so. Going up in the local paper. But Jaws, as I told you last week, it was one of my favourite horrors of all time. And I'm a bit of a nerd for this film. I've bought books reading about it. I've got this massive Martha's Vineyard book about the making of it. Now, I don't know if you know a lot about this film, but it went over production by about 2 times what it was supposed to cost.
Yeah, and days as well. Yeah, it was about like 3 times.
It went on a couple of months. It was still to this day, I think, Spielberg said it's the most stressful and kind of challenging time of his entire life. companies were ringing up saying, you need to pull this, this isn't working. The motorised robot, well, the motorised shark kept failing. The actor that played Quint actually did that scene that you were just talking about pretty much hammered. So he turned up to set a lot of the time, and as you know, he was a bit of an alcoholic. He would turn up and need sobering up quite a lot before he did these scenes. And a lot of that you did, what you just picked up on then, he was half cut.
Yeah.
He was also adding a lot of extra lines in. It wasn't in the original dialogue.
Yeah, I read they basically gave him the outline of what they wanted him to say, and he went away and tailored it.
Yeah.
And it just came back with this work of art.
And I think they did it in only a couple of shots.
Yeah.
And you see, when you watch it back, yeah, you know he's probably a little bit drink, a bit half cut, because he's got some spirit, isn't it? And then showing off the scars, and they're all getting a bit drunk.
Yeah.
But it's added to a more authentic performance.
Well, yeah, you couldn't get more of an authentic performance.
But apparently he was a belligerent, drunken old bastard on set, and there's one story, apparently they were out on the boat, and he was getting pissed up between scenes. And at one point, just sort of drowning his sorrows, he turned around and went, oh, I wish I could quit drinking. So Richard Dreyfuss grabbed his drink and just threw it over the side of the boat and went, there you go. But it's just brilliant. Like, some of the... you know, Spielberg's a master of his craft now, but he was 28 when he made this. But some of the shots, even back then, are phenomenal. All the stuff on the sea is amazing. Just the very fact that they managed to film it without showing land at any point is a technical achievement in itself. But there's a shot near the start. It's when Brody's on the beach and he's sat in his deck chair, and I think his missus is behind him. And it's when the little kid first gets eaten by the shark. And what they did to produce the shot, it's the camera was on a track, so they pushed the camera forward on the track, but zoomed out as it went inwards. So that meant that Brody in the foreground stayed the same size, but it meant that the perspective in the background completely changed. And it's a really eerie, weird, sort of disorientating shot. It's standard in, you will see that in every film now. You know, I've seen it in like Smashing Pumpkins videos. You see that. But he was one of the pioneers of it. I don't know that he was necessarily the first one, but he was one of the first.
And he did it properly.
Did it properly, did it beautifully.
Do you know that the opening scene for that film, so you know the very first attack, it's dark, it's a very dark scene, there's not much light at all, it's a night time, they're going skinny dipping.
Yeah.
The girl goes into the water and you see her, she's having a lot of fun, getting naked, and you see her getting basically pulled under left and right.
Yeah.
The way they actually created that scene, they couldn't make it look right, because at the end of the day there's no real shark pulling her left and right.
No,
the force of that shark to pull you, you're not going to be able to recreate. There was no CGI, there was no computer. So what they actually did is they tied two ropes to her. So they got around her waist, they tied really thick knots around her. They had two people in the water either side of her, basically taking it in turns to pull her, as if it's like a...
Apparently they have 300-pound weights on the end of each rope.
And they were absolutely
to pull her.
Pulling it left and right. They said it was cutting the side of her, but look at the way it came out, that scene.
The agony on her face was very real.
Amazing.
The stuff you wouldn't get away with now.
One of my favourite shots... Right. God, we could talk about Jaws for 2 hours.
Let's.
Let's
get to the end, Jaws
when
special.
I was worried that you were going to say to me, because what I get a lot of is when I talk about Jaws to people is, yeah, but the end of the day, the shark looks really dated and crap now. And that's what I get a lot of. But when we first see it go under the boat and the scale of it and the size, it looks real to me. And the very first time when he's, is it Hooper? I think he's looking out and throwing some bait into the water. And he's smoking and looks around.
Oh, it's Brody.
Oh, it's Brody. And in the background, you first see it up close. I don't care what anyone says. You will shit your pants if you've not seen that film before. Because that scene looks real.
Yeah.
There is no doubt that looks like a...
I kind of want to go away and watch it again.
I'm going to watch it tonight.
Yeah. It was so good. I mean, as you know, I don't get scared by this sort of stuff. Those sort of jumpy moments, my instant reaction is to laugh.
Yeah.
So that scene where Brody's there throwing chum into the water, having his fag, and then you just see the shark pop up behind him. I burst out laughing. I was like, that is awesome. That's the sort of thing I really like. It doesn't scare me, but I enjoy the hell out of it. Again, with the scene when earlier on in the film, where Brody and Hooper go out after they're a bit pissed and they decide to go and cut open the shark, the first shark they caught, and they decide to go out in the water and they find the fisherman's boat that's been capsized, and Hooper's snorkeling underneath, and then there's a bite in the hull where the shark had bit it, and then the dead bloke's head just pops out. And
that's horrible.
That again made me piss myself. I love stuff like that. It's hilarious, but it's so, so good. I was about to say I can't recommend this film highly enough. No one needs my goddamn recommendation to watch Jaws. Everyone loves it. I'm the only person in the earth who hasn't seen it. But it is amazing. So happy to have seen it.
On that note, I'm going on holiday in a couple of weeks, so I can't wait to go swimming in the sea again. Brilliant.
Oh, fantastic.
If Adam, you hate your homework, we've had a really shit end to this, because at the moment...
I feel that I can't really follow that. on Jaws.
Don't then. Cheers.
Done. The Mist. Yeah, all right, yeah. So I had The Mist. Frank Darabont doing Stephen King again, I think. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, if you've got a Stephen King novel that needs to be adapted into a film, Frank Darabont's the guy you
get Frank in.
You call in. I really enjoyed it, actually. I was quite surprised. I wasn't sure how I'd feel about it. I kind of read the premise and thought, it could be a bit bad. It could be a really sort of B-grade horror movie. But really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. The monster design was cool as well. The Mist creatures, the design of them was awesome. The acting was good. I mean, Darabont is, as I say, is kind of the guy you call in now to do a Stephen King film.
Yeah. Only if you want it done properly. So Stephen King's had a lot of adaptations done. So we've got Firestarter, Carrot. The list goes on. You won't believe how many films are his.
Yeah, his. Yeah.
Remember Shawshank, Green Mile, and now The Mist. They're the films that have stood out. Yeah. Everything else that have had adaptations, I'm going to say this now, are pretty much dog shit.
Even The Shining, I mean, Stephen King hates The Shining adaptation. Kubrick's a genius, but Stephen King hates that film, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
So there was a really shit TV miniseries.
Yeah, he loves that. Yeah. You get a shit actor, no budget, you know, real dreadful team of people. I'm waiting for you to say Kevin Smith behind it. You get him to do a Stephen King
You
film.
Said it, not me, brother.
You get Stephen King will absolutely adore it, you know.
I think that's a good thing. That's the thing I like. I mean, I like Darabont anyway, because Green Mile was in my top five films of all time.
And yeah.
It will always be. Shawshank's not far off.
Everyone I speak to is their favourite film, so he's done alright there.
Is it still number one on the IMDb, Shawshank? It was for many years.
I think so.
Is
that or The Godfather? It kind of switches between the two.
Probably Interstellar right now.
I think that was about number seven or something.
Yeah,
it's
gone up
there.
Ridiculous. And then Darabont also did Walking Dead season one.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of the man for that
adaptation.
But The Mist itself was... It was a very odd film for me, because when it started out, I wasn't really sure what to expect. Like, it starts off after kind of a hurricane.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Things are smashed up. So they drive into town, they go to this grocery store. And then this mist kind of descends. And Jeffrey DeMunn, who is in pretty much anything Frank Darabont seems to do.
He was Dale in Walking Dead.
Dale in Walking Dead. He plays one of the prison guards in The Green Mile.
So he does, yeah.
He also was in Mob City, which is a series Frank Darabont did.
So, I haven't watched that yet. I've been meaning to watch that.
Darabont is another one of these guys who likes to reuse a lot of people, because Laurie Holden, who plays Andrea in The Walking Dead, is in The Mist as well. Yeah. Melissa McBride, who plays Carol in The Walking Dead, she's in The Mist as well. She plays a very brief role as a woman who's left her kids at home and she walks off into The Mist. But it was just so tense, because you didn't really know what was going on for a lot of the film. You just kind of... waiting for things to happen, and then when they did, I mean, there's a great scene where it's at night and they've got all these lights out into the mist so they can try and see what's going on, and all of a sudden these kind of insects start flying towards the window and start breaking against the window, and then they're flying in the shot and they're being hunted down by these kind of mist creature bird type things, and they're setting them on fire, they're flying around the store burning up things in the store. But it was a very odd film to watch. And the scariest moment for me, and I have arachnophobia anyway, is where they have to find the mist creature spiders. Now they go into this sort of, is it a diner with pharmaceutical?
Yeah.
And they're looking for pharmaceutical stuff to treat a burns victim. And they go into this place and they realise there's kind of loads of, it's all quite empty and they're wondering what's going on. They see all this webbing around. And this one kind of military police person is kind of webbed up to the wall. And as he's sort of saying, it's our fault, you know, standard kind of horror lines. And as they kind of open up his shirt, they realise that things are moving under his skin.
It's horrible.
And then these spiders start kind of bursting out of him. And then the sort of adult spiders then start coming and trying to hit people with their webs to web them up as well. And now, for someone with arachnophobia, that's going to fuck you up completely. So that was really frightening. But I need to talk about the end now.
Now this is a...
Is this the really bleak ending?
This is a horrible
I wish Ben had seen this film, because if you don't
know what happened, I've read
it. Okay,
I know
that's fine
happens.
Then, that's fine, because this ending, and I'll let you say, Adam, what happens, but this is one of the endings for me that left me feeling completely
cold
and there's no other film like it, and I went away and was silent for about a week after watching it. It was... horrific.
And you'll tell us the ending in a second, Adam, but correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, you might have heard this, but I believe that Stephen King said that he preferred the film ending to his own book ending. I'm sure he said he saw it and went, God, you know, I wish I'd have written that. That's perfect.
Wow.
He gets very criticised for the endings of his book. Everyone thinks that Stephen King can't deliver the final part to a book.
Okay.
Absolute bullshit. He's the best writer in the world.
Fair enough. That's my review. So the ending of it is absolutely horrendous. So they kind of make this a beeline out of the grocery store because they run away, get into a Jeep, and as they're driving off, there's five of them. Kid, the dad, and then an old woman, another guy, and Laurie Holden Andrea from The Walking Dead. I can't remember.
Good, you've done your research.
I don't care.
The five of them in the Jeep.
Five of them in the Jeep. So they're driving around in the Jeep. So he ends up going back to his house on the lake and finds his wife's already been webbed up by these mist creature spider things and she's dead. So, you know, let's gloss over that. Smile. So he's a bit upset, naturally, as you would be.
And then
they end up trying to drive until the mist is gone, basically. So they're driving, driving, driving. Eventually the Jeep runs out of fuel. They hear a kind of this noise and think, oh, yeah, this is another big creature. It's going to come for us, it's going to kill us all. So the dad kind of gets the revolver he's got and he looks and finds four bullets. So he shoots, they all make the decision, he shoots his kid, the woman, the old woman, and the man, and leaves himself alive to be killed by the monsters, does the noble thing and lets them all have the peaceful death.
Yeah.
Gets out the car, yelling, you know, come on then, come and get me. And the mist just starts to retract and the MPs are there, the military are there, and they're just pushing the mist creatures back, burning them. And that's when you realise that they were literally 30 seconds from being saved.
Yeah.
And he's just gone and shot his kid and his wife's dead. And it's the bleakest end. I just remember sitting there thinking, what?
And he's looking, he's got the gun in his hand, and you see him looking at his son, and he's kind of, he's first without the gun, he's like kind of acting it out. He's like, oh, what would it look like? And just trying to work out where's best to shoot him in the face and kill his own son.
And then there's a bit where even after he's killed everyone, he doesn't really want to live with himself anyway. So he tries to pull the trigger more and more times into his own mouth to try and just magic a bullet out of nothing and kill himself. But when he gets saved, it's just horrendous. I was just speechless when it ended, and I was sitting there thinking, Jesus Christ.
That defines bleak, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just shot your kid in the face, and then 10 seconds later, I shouldn't have to.
In the book, he doesn't kill his family, and he looks at his watch, and he notices that it's moving.
Oh, it's Morse code,
It's Morse code how to save himself. So he notices the dial on his watch is starting to trigger, so he gets some chalk and starts writing on the dashboard and works out that Morse code is actually a way to get rid of the monsters.
Oh, and it turns out that his kid had been in the fifth dimension, and it was his kid who sent the monsters the whole time.
Well, no, his kid was his granddad in the fifth dimension, so it's really weird, but it's something to do with Nolan, but it's really, really good.
So that's Mr. Stella.
Yeah. Terrible.
But anyway, I really enjoyed the film, and I thought it was cool. I'm interested to read the book now.
Yeah.
Because I've kind of done that with most of Darabont's adaptations. Like I read saw The Shawshank Redemption and went to read Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption. Saw The Green Mile and then went on to read The Green Mile as a book.
Which is a collection of short stories originally. Everyone forgets that.
Yeah, it was published as individual books, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So now I'm interested. I might actually go out and buy The Mist and read that.
Cool.
Brilliant.
Even if Stephen King says the ending isn't as good as the film.
Yeah.
But that's the homework then.
A good batch of homework again, boys, yeah.
At this time, I don't think I've got any homework set.
Me neither.
No. So, Ben.
Yeah.
I was reading on the website, skiptothend.co.uk.
What website's that?
website.
Wait, sorry, say again, what website?
skiptothend.co.uk.
skiptothend.co.uk.
And just to clarify, that's not skiptothend.com, because that is some sort of bodybuilding website.
That's Adam's own project.
I'm happy to advertise those boys. I'll get them some hits, but it's skiptothend.co.uk.
Just so if they do a podcast, they better advertise it.
Better bloody ad.
We're not going to start a fire because they're bodybuilders, but...
I was reading you've done a list section on there about what we've discussed previously, and I was reading through the best directors, because it's nice to kind of read it instead of hear about it. Now, tell me about your favourite director of all time, because we were talking in the office today about other films that he's done.
In the Skip to the End offices. The Towers where we run our business.
Exactly. So, tell me a couple of titles that he's done.
What, Paul Thomas Anderson?
Yeah.
Punch Drunk Love?
Yep.
Magnolia?
Yep.
There Will Be Blood?
Yep.
The Master?
There we go, The Master. I've not seen that film. And everyone told me that it was one of the greatest films of the last 5 years.
Yeah, it's
beautiful. Some of the standout performances. I didn't realise that Joaquin Phoenix is in it.
Yeah, and he kicks ass in it. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
If I'm right, they actually both got nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Because Philip Seymour Hoffman lost out to Christoph Waltz. And I believe Joaquin Phoenix lost out to Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln.
Yeah.
So.
Standard. But that's
two nominations,
film,
not
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, I mean, this the way you've sold it to me, the actors alone, you know what I've thought of her, my favourite film of last year. So I'd like to see more work with Joaquin Phoenix. So that's the film that I'd like to take as my homework, if that's good with you.
Yeah, and it was actually three actors. Amy Adams was nominated
as well.
Definitely watch that, Mark. It's really good. And, you know, it's not about Scientology per se, but it's about the birth of a cult that bears a lot of striking similarities with Scientology. So if you know anything about sort of L. Ron Hubbard and how that came about, it's a fascinating film.
I know loads about it.
So it's a fascinating film from that aspect, and also just because it's a bloody good film.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, The Master.
Adam. I believe at this point we've not got you any homework.
No, we don't. it's time for an admission, I guess.
Yeah, an admission of guilt. What haven't you seen?
What haven't I seen that everyone... I'll tell you what, there is one thing that one of my friends always used to recommend. I never got a chance to watch it, and I do think it is probably one of those films a lot of people have seen. And I think even Ben might chastise me for this. Not as much as Goodfellas.
Right.
But Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, hella good film. Yeah, you should absolutely watch that.
Because, again, it's a De Niro...
Jump on the De Niro bandwagon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know what? I'll go for that.
Yep, great choice. I'm looking forward to discussing that next week.
As you may not know, we've launched a website now, which is skiptotheend.co.uk. Haven't talked about it too much, but, yeah, we've launched it. There's going to be regular published articles on there. It's got all of our old episodes on there if you want to go back and listen to it from the start. We've got our reviews on there, all our lists of our favourite directors or horrors or comedies, so go and visit it. Now, we also...
Visit where, sorry?
Skiptotheend.co.uk. Okay.
And on there you can also find our links to our Twitter, Instagram, our email...
Facebook,
of course, yeah. Skiptotheend.co.uk.
So, with Twitter, which is at STTE Podcast, we've had three questions come through. Now, one of the people is on there is called Dirk Diggler. Now, we all know where that's from.
I'd like to think that is actually Mark Wahlberg.
So if it is, thank you very much. And his question is, and it's ridiculous, is favourite pet in a movie?
Einstein.
Gizmo. Gizmo was a pet, wasn't he?
Yep.
Einstein, Doc's dog from Back to the Future.
Okay.
It's a great one. I'm going to go with the dog off Dennis. Mr. Wilson was against it. I liked him. He was a good little
pet.
What
was his name?
Dog.
Yeah. What about Beethoven from the several Beethoven films? Do you remember him?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What about any of the pets from Look Who's Talking?
Lassie.
Yeah.
Was he a pet, though? I don't know. He had no owner. Was he stray?
I don't know. He had Tim. Wasn't
he
Timmy?
Should have
been put down.
What? Stray.
Oh.
What about the pets from Pet Sematary?
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're dead to me now.
Terrible.
Any more pets?
I think I'm going with Einstein. I think Einstein, Doc's dog's cool. First dog to travel through time.
I'm going with whatever I said at first that I forgot.
What was it?
Oh, Gizmo.
And my pet is going to be the dog from Dennis the movie. Brilliant.
Cheers for that.
Nick Eversfield has given us two questions this week.
Who?
Cheating.
Would you prefer... This is ridiculous. Worst question week ever. Would you rather be Nicolas Cage or John Travolta's character in Face Off? Nick Cage.
I'd say Cage. Cage gets some sort of craziest scenes. I remember there's a scene where he's like flourishing two
guns.
Is it
before they
dandy.
Change face or what?
Doesn't matter. You choose.
Well, I'm still...
Further turn heel.
That makes no sense, because then I'm just choosing to be Nick Cage and John Travolta's
face. Okay, then. Let's be that, then. Let's change
right,
it.
I'll be Nick Cage
Whose
with John Travolta's
face. Would you rather
face?
Have Nicolas Cage's or John Travolta's?
I'd rather have Nick Cage's face, but John Travolta's hairline.
Yep.
Done. I'll take that as well.
I'd rather have John Travolta's face with Nick Cage's hairline.
No,
if anyone's good on Photoshop, send us that in.
I've had Nick Cage's hairline. It's not good.
And the final one, would you rather die from the chest burster from Alien or being chased and hacked to death by Michael Myers in Halloween?
The former. I think the chest burster would kill you quicker.
Yeah.
I'd rather be chased and hacked to death because I'd, you know, I'd try and kick him off and
not. Plus, if you have the chest burst, you kind of understand what it's like to be pregnant.
Yeah. And also, if a man came at you and was attacking you, would you beat him up?
I would try my best to beat him off. Maybe before he could get to me, I'd try and take him from behind.
Yeah.
And give him a fatal blow that he wasn't expecting.
What if you're in the woods? He's discovered your camp.
Yep.
And would you use your kind of your hole as bait?
I would have to, and I'd make sure that I got the biggest weapon I could find, and I'd attack him from behind.
And if he did have a big weapon,
yep.
And you knew he had it,
yep.
Would you say to him, I know you've got a big weapon, give it to me now?
No, because I think that would end up in him giving me a real big stabbing. Keep your questions coming in on @STTEpodcast or facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. And finally, check out our website. Adam, what's the website?
skiptotheend.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of episode 8 of the Skip to the End podcast. On the next podcast, we're going to be reviewing The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. A lot of talk going around that he's going to be nominated for the Best Actor Oscar for that, so we're looking forward to that one. We're also going to be discussing Under the Radar movies, so that's films that we love but no one else appears to have heard of. We're also going to be talking about our top three quintessentially 80s movies, movies that sum up the excesses of that era. And then, of course, we'll be talking about our homework. I'm going to be watching Monsters University. Mark?
The Master.
And Adam?
Once Upon a Time in America.
So that's on the next episode. We'll catch you then.
Skip to the end. Go to UK.